It is so good to be back in Nebraska again. And I want to give the best congratulations to the Cornhusker for their 20 years. I am just really thrilled. I didn't realize we all started about the same time. And I'd especially like to thank Dick and Peggy. They have brought this thing together. They've kept it going. And not only that, they have encouraged speakers from all over the country and brought them here and given them an opportunity to share. And they have given me the opportunity over the years to do things that I never thought I could do and to stretch myself and to grow and to learn about the program in a way I've never learned before. And I'm very, very grateful for them being here. Y'all are very blessed to have them here. Well, my name is Mary Pearl, and I'm an Al-Anon who's happy, joyous, and free. Oh, it is exciting here today. I hope that it'll be as exciting when we're through. When Dick called me and he said, "We want you to come back," and I said, "Yes, yes, yes." And he said, "Well, you didn't even let me give you the dates." I said, "It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter." I said, "I have always loved coming to Nebraska. Y'all are enthusiastic in the fellowship here. And I love the enthusiasm in the program. And I love people who love working the steps. And I love people who are willing to try different things and what have you." And so he said, "Well, what would you like to do? Something dicey?" And I said, "I'm too old for sex, Dick." And I said, "Well, what'd you have in mind?" He said, "Well, what would you like to do?" And I said, "Oh, I think I could probably just go crazy and talk about the big book." And he said, "Really? I like that." And I went, "Oh, God, what have I said?" A little terrified feeling came on the inside. You know, in a lot of places, it's not popular for an Al-Anon to mention the big book, much less read the big book, study the big book, or use the big book. But I haven't really cared about that ever in my life. You know, I'm an Arkansas rebel. What can I say? You know, just don't, when you tell me I can't do something, I have an insatiable need to do it. I don't know why. I guess that's just one of those defects. But I want to emphasize today that I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I have been raised on the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me to get up and to share and not mention the big book just wouldn't be right, you know? Because that, you know, we're asked to share how we did it. And if you think about it, you know, when Al-Anon started, there was some stuff that was written in that book 13 years before Al-Anon ever came to pass, you know? And so obviously they were thinking about us at the time. But what I want to do is I want to tell you how I learned to make the big book mine. I'm not an authority on the big book, but I do know how the big book works for me. And that's what I want to share. Making that book yours, just like anything else. Now, this doesn't mean that I don't read and study and practice the Al-Anon program and the literature. We have some really good literature in Al-Anon, but the big book enhanced my program to a dimension. It just made it all come alive for me because, you know, when I came in to the rooms of Al-Anon, we were not a bunch of happy campers. You didn't hear much laughter in the rooms of Al-Anon. We were sort of stuck with our hands to our head. And over there doing, "Woe is me, woe is me." And what attracted me to the program was the fact that I got to go to open AA meetings, because that's where you heard the laughter. And for God's sake, we love alcoholics. That's why we're here. Now, in our own Al-Anon preamble, it says that we learn to give love and encouragement and understanding to the alcoholic. And how better do you understand the alcoholic than to study the book that is written about alcoholism? And we are taught in Al-Anon, alcoholism is a family disease. If so, then I need to know everything there is to know about alcoholism, because that's my disease too. Now, I know J.D. got cancer. And I read everything I could on cancer. I wanted to know everything. How do we fight this disease? How do we get past this point, you know? And it's the same thing with me and alcoholism. Like I say, I love the part in the book where it says, "When I found God, I found myself." And that's true. You know, I didn't have a clue about those things. And that's some of the things I want to share with you is how I use that. I got my first big book, which I still have here, and I got it 20 years ago. And J.D. gave it to me. He gave it to me for my birthday in 1977. And he said, "Here, I'm tired of not being able to find mine when I want it." You know, I just couldn't understand in the beginning why we need to everybody have their own book on stuff. You know, if you had one book in the house, why would you have to have? And then he didn't like because I wrote in his book, you know. And I circle things, but I was doing that so that he wouldn't miss it, you know. I've often heard if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, put it in his big book. The thing about the big book was, the first time I read it, I'm going to be honest with you, I saw everything that he needed to do, and I was learning about him. But as I continued to read and study the book over the years, all of a sudden, a real miraculous thing happened. I found me on the pages of that book. I found me. My home group has a big book study meeting every Monday night at 6:30. So if you're ever down Arkansas way in North Little Rock, well, you're more than welcome to come and join us. It could be very enlightening. I get tickled at the alcoholics who come to the Al-Anon big book study, and they say, "We never thought about it that way. You know, we never thought about it. We've done it ours." But what's also funny, too, is it really scares them when they find out how many Al-Anons know about the big book. Well, we started that meeting in January of 1989, and it's helped us tremendously to understand how the disease affects the family, how it's affected our lives, because it is a family disease. Now, in our Al-Anon ODAP book on July 21st, it says there are no rules and regulations, no management, control, nobody says you must do this or you may not do that. It's a government by principles, and what binds us together is a common problem solved by understanding and mutual service. And I feel that our problem is alcoholism here. And so there, that right there tells me it's okay to get my help where I can get it. Most people I find who are against Al-Anon's reading and studying the big book are those who have never done that. They don't have a clue what's in there. You know, it's like, "I'm scared, but don't go in there." You know, it's, well, we always fear that we know nothing about. You know, it's just like change. When you say change, so you don't know what's going to happen when you do that, and so you get afraid, and I think that's it. But I love the book when it says, it talks about there's a principle which a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance, which is contempt prior to investigation, you know. And I think that happens to a lot of people. They're afraid to look in something. They're afraid what they might find. But the big book to me is like sort of going to life 101, you know. I miss that somewhere. I don't know about y'all, but, you know, when I was going to school, they didn't tell you how to live. You learned how to read, write, and do some arithmetic, but they did not tell me how to do relationships. They didn't tell me how to live in this world. They didn't say how to live life on life's terms, and I didn't have a clue. Now, a lot of my friends in AA will tell you that I'm just a six-pack short of being an alcoholic myself. Well, I'm here as living proof that I am not an alcoholic because I take the alcoholic test every 3 years. I take a drink and then put it down and see if I have a problem with it. Now, to explain to you, we were having a business meeting in our group here just back in May, we were having our quarterly business meeting, and I was, while they were having their meeting, I told them, "I'm going to be on a jet going to Hawaii, and while y'all are sitting here fighting out the World War III, I'm going to be sipping a chichi on my lanai." Nah! 2 weeks after I was in Hawaii, it occurred to me I had forgotten to get my drink! Now, if that doesn't prove I'm not an alcoholic, I don't know what is. But I will tell you this. As soon as I remembered I had forgotten, I called and got one. And then I forgot to have another one before I left. You know, I enjoyed it while it was, but you know, it's real funny. You know, the alcoholic doesn't realize, but with the real Al-Anon, you know, we are strangely insane when it comes to alcoholics, not just to the alcohol, you know. We're told it's a family disease and we've been affected by someone else's drinking. And I can tell you that I was not affected by anyone's drinking in my immediate family, but my mother was raised in it. And let me tell you, if you're ever affected by an Al-Anon, you have a much greater problem than if you were affected. Well, there is no known reason for the neuroses, for God's sake. You know, you just know that you've got someone that ought to be a card-carrying certifiable nutcase that's out there functioning, you know. And you don't have a clue. But you see, that's how the disease continues on from person to person. And, you know, when I worked with the Alateen kids, I was so amazed to find out that their biggest resentments were not with the practicing alcoholic, but it was with the dingy Al-Anon, you know. I understand he's drunk and he does that when he's drunk, but what's the matter with her? And I'm looking and I don't know. You know, and I'd say, I never had kids. So see, I am not responsible for one adult child. I'm here to tell you. You know, I don't have an allergy to alcohol. I don't have that allergy to alcohol. But I do have an obsession. You know, I mean, I can obsess on anything. If I think about it three times, I'm probably obsessing. You know, because I never do anything a little bit. You know, do it till you die on the spot. My God, you know. And so some of my favorites were excitement, attention, being needed. These were my obsessions, you know. I wanted to be loved. It seemed to me all my life I went everywhere just saying, all I want is just love me. Love me, you son of a bitch. Love me. You know, it's hard to love people when they're talking to you like that. You know, I'm going to make you prove your love. And they say alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. I believe it, but more than that, the alcoholic is cunning, baffling, and powerful, you know. On one side, you got the allergy to drink, and you've got an obsession to drink it, you know. With an Al-Anon, you got an obsession to manage and control another human being, you know. Namely, the alcoholic, you know. We seem to be obsessed with that person drinking, you know, and we believe that the problem is alcohol. And pretty soon we begin to really, both of us, think that the problem is alcohol. But the problem isn't alcohol. And that's what I learned in the book. The problem is alcoholism. It doesn't become alcoholism. You know, somebody sobers up, you think sobriety is the end of it all. I mean, we have reached our goal, and it's not. You know, it's just one of the things. It's a symptom of a disease. Alcohol is only the symptom, you know. And the book tells you that, you know. And it doesn't. And what's amazing to me is, do you know a lot of people out there think the big book is designed to get an alcoholic sober? And that's not what the book says. The book says that it's there to help you to find a power within yourself, a higher power that'll help you to learn how to live so you don't have to drink. You know, it's not just about getting an alcoholic sober. And so it stresses that need of a higher power if we're going to overcome and recreate our lives. And God knows, haven't we all wanted to recreate our lives? How many times did you say, I want to start over? I wish I could have overs. You know, as a kid playing jacks, you know, you throw a rotten hand, you yell overs. And I wanted to do that all my life. And it didn't seem like I'd do any different, you know, until I got here and found out how to do overs. You know, you can start your life over again here. It's not like it used to be. And I also learned that a person has to make their own diagnosis, you know. I was always a person that, in fact, in my home group, every time we got somebody in that ended up over in AA, you know, I got the sponsoring for some reason. And I said, God, am I in charge of diagnosis and referrals? I'm, you know, what is this deal? What's going on? What's going on? And the thing about it is, no, we each have to diagnose it's our own problem. And that's just like, we get lots of people who come into Al-Anon that think the problem is someone else. And they leave. And if they live, we'll get them back, you know? Because the thing about it is, the problem is not somebody else. The problem is me. When I'm looking in the mirror, I'm looking at the problem. And I didn't know that. I always thought it was somebody out there, you know. And I had to control. And, you know, an alcoholic needs to control their environment to be comfortable. Well, what does an Al-Anon do if we don't try to control another person to control our environment, you know? And that's the fearful nature of the disease, you know, that self-centered fear. And everyone around it is affected by the disease, you know. And my thing was, I kept trying to get it all together, you know. And I would tell JD, if you just straighten up and do right, you know. And I can remember one night in particular, my sister, God love my sister, she bought JD a wine-making kit for Christmas one year. I was not amused. And it's like, but you see, I can't tell her she can't buy a wine-making kit because I'm trying to hide from the family the fact that he's drinking. So therefore, I have to go, oh, look, JD, you have a wine-making kit. And he's going, yeah. Well, I read the instructions, and I knew he didn't have a prayer because it talked about an aging process of a year. make it know there's a year time limit. See, they know, they know. And so one night we were going to this friend of mine. She was pregnant and having a little shower. And so all the guys were going to stay at her house, and all the girls were going over to the girls' house where we were having the party. And we lived in Jacksonville, and this was in a southwest Little Rock home, so it was quite a distance away. And so when I was taking my shower, I came out, and J.D. was sitting with what looked to be like an ice tea glass, which is a big glass in the South. We don't serve them little dinky things. We use big ones. And I said, "What you drinking?" Because that was always very curious about that. And he said, "Grape Kool-Aid." And I said, "Oh, okay." And so when we got ready to go, he said, "Why don't you drive? I'm tired." And I said, "Okay." That should have been another signal to me, but I was focusing on this shower. And so as we're driving along, all of a sudden he just went down in the floorboard. I mean, he just sort of poured out of the seat and went down in the floorboard. And I'm looking at him and I said, "You're drunk!" And he said, "Really?" And I said, "Well, now you straighten up!" And so he's just stiff, you know, he said, "I'm straight." I said, "You get it together! I don't have time to take you back home. You've got to get it together!" And so J.D. said, "All's right." Now, if I'd had any sense at all, I would have gone back home, you know. But no, you see, I'm on a quest. So I go on, and when we get there, I told him, I said, "Now, when you get out of this truck, you do not wobble. You do not stagger. You are going to straighten up." And he said, "Okay." And he got out, and he did a double flip right into a cactus bed. So the guy spent the rest of the evening picking the cactus out of J.D. I came back from the shower and they're saying, "Take this person." And I'm going, "What's the matter?" And they were trying to play poker and half of his cards were facing the wrong direction. Now he was with a bunch of would-be Al-Anons because they're all trying to fix him, you know. And they're pretty disgusted with him. But that was the kind of way things were at our house, you know, trying to get it together, trying to keep the illusion that everything's okay, you know. And when I read that big book, like I say, that first time, God, I knew he was on the pages of that book, you know, and I could identify where he needed stuff. But it was when I began to make an identification, when I began to identify with the problems, then there was hope for me. Because if I can identify with the problems, I'll identify with the solution. And it, you know, it just took a while to be able to see that. I saw the progression of the disease in myself. From the time that I was a little girl, I could see that all along my entire life that I'd had patterns repeated over and over and over with different people, different places, but the same thing was happening, you know. And all during this period of time, I knew, this doesn't work. But somehow or another, I would go back and do that again and again and again. See, self-knowledge really doesn't help you much. And I kept thinking that it would. You know, if you knew that wouldn't work, then why do you do it again? I don't know. It's called an obsession. And it's like the bottom line is, I know it doesn't work, but in lieu of having a different way, I'll go back and do the known every darn time. You know, it's like something has got to be put in there because my mind will say, this time it's going to be different. And it's not different till I'm different, until something happens. Now, I heard my first Al-Anon speaker was Ramona from Oklahoma. God, I love that woman. And when she would talk about her God, she'd say, "I would give you my God, but I would rob you of the joy of finding your own." And I'd say, that's okay. I don't mind. Rob me. You know, it's like she had such a faith. And when she would take to the podium, there was a glow that happened with that woman. And I wanted what she had, you know. And I'd say, give me your God. Because, see, I'd been really close-minded about God stuff all my life. Because, like, say, when I was 12 years old and my daddy died, I had been told that God loved me. And I could not believe that God loved me because if he did, why did daddy die? Why did daddy die? And a 12-year-old child doesn't know how to communicate what she's thinking and what she's feeling to you. I needed help then. You know, and I needed help all my life, but help wasn't there for me because I couldn't reach out and get help. Because I was told you can do anything you want to if you just set your mind to it. Well, now that'll kill you. I'm here to tell you that'll kill you. I quit going to church. My mother changed churches after my father died because of her fear of driving. The church that we went to was on the other side of Little Rock, and we lived in East North Little Rock. And she was afraid, and so we went from a very church that talked about a very loving God to Hard Shell Baptist Church. Now, I'm not knocking Baptists. I'm just sharing experience here. And they had all these little rules and stuff there, and I knew I was guilty, you know. I mean, they were telling you you were guilty if you thought about stuff, and I was thinking, you know, I'm, you know. And so if you think about it, you might as well have done it. And so, I mean, you're gone already. I mean, you're condemned. And so I figured, well, I was going to go to hell anyway, so what the heck, I was going to have some fun before I went. Because it seemed to me that the people who were having fun were doing things that were not along those lines. And then a couple of times during the active drinking, J.D. would get this, he'd say, let's start going back to church. It's like intuitively he knew something was wrong spiritually. And I didn't really want to go, but if it would help him to keep from drinking, then I would go. I'd do just about anything to keep him from drinking. That's how we are. But I always felt out of place, and then something would happen that would push me away. We started going to church when we were dating, and sometimes JD would stay over at the house overnight and this kind of thing. Well, you know, when you live in a little southern town, there's a lot of gossip that goes on, and all of a sudden one day we got a delegation of the sweet little old ladies from the Baptist church telling us they didn't want us in their church anymore because we were living in sin. And I was the kind of person who was dangerous because I knew just enough about the Bible to be able to quote it back, and I said, I think all have sinned and come, you know. And I'm saying, if you don't have sinners in your church, you ain't going to have nobody on Sunday. And you know, I didn't want to be one of them, but by God, it hurt to be rejected by them. I'm telling you, that hurt. And so I said, I'll never go back. And it's like every time something like that happened, I gave God credit for it instead of the people. In other words, God didn't want me there, and that's the reason he sent those nasty little old women from that Baptist church. And so then later, J.D. decided, he said, well, we'll change. We'll go to a Methodist church. And I said, I've never been in one of those. So we went, and I went that morning to the Sunday service, and I had on a beautiful black gabardine suit. It was a long pants suit and a three-piece. It was very, very pretty. I wore it to work all the time, and I was stopped at the front door of the church and said, you can't come in here wearing pants. And I said, now, if you want to come Sunday night, you can come Sunday night. And I said, well, what's the difference between the Sunday morning God and the Sunday night God that you can roll one in and you can take one out? I said, I don't understand what difference it makes. And they said, well, you can't come in here. So one more time, I felt pushed away from God. I felt pushed away from God by man's laws is what it was. But those old ideas had to be defeated now before I was going to be able to make a surrender here. You know, you get such a block here between you and those kind of things that when people say God, automatically I thought of religion. I didn't think about a spiritual God. I didn't think about my creator God. I thought about that God that was saying, I don't want you in my church. I don't want you here anymore. That was what I had. Now, like I say, surrender is hard for me. I don't know about y'all, but it doesn't make any difference what it is. Surrender's hard for me, you know. But you have to accept things, and you have to surrender. And the process continues for me even today. I mean, I've had an ongoing thing now for 3 years. I've had this situation with a cat. Now, I got jumped on by my sister's cat. It was a Siamese, and I had to have 16 stitches taken when I was about 8 or 9 years old. So I'm not real thrilled about the little kitty cats. You know? It's like I don't trust them. They come up and sort of curve around your leg. I think he's getting ready to nail me, you know. It's like, get this thing off of me. And have you ever noticed when they get on you, they want to go, ee, 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 ee. What is it with those crazy things? You know, I don't know. But I'm not one of those likes to run around with claw marks all in my body. Now, you may be a cat person, and that's fine, but I'm a dog person. And I think dogs should eat cats. I mean, that's just the way it is. Well, and like I say, and I have confirmation on this. Now, 3 years ago, I had this desire, and I made me a beautiful, beautiful front flower bed. And I mean, it's a long thing, and it's a free form, and I got these New Mexico River rock to outline it, and they're just gorgeous. I mean, it's beautiful, and I had these impatiens, and I don't know, you know, you shouldn't really plant something called impatiens anyway. But, you know, I'm out there and I'm watering them with my Miracle-Gro. You know, I'm going to be one of those people they put on TV and say, where'd you get them 25-foot-tall impatiens? Well, I use Miracle-Gro. But anyway, they're about 4 foot tall out there, and people are stopping when they go by. They're amazed, you know, and it's just all this profusion of all different colors, and they're just absolutely fantastic. And I'm so proud. Oh God, I'm so proud. I did that. And then all of a sudden I come home one day and there's a hole in the middle of my impatiens. And I mean, impatiens are little tender plants. And if something lays down on them, it breaks them off even with the ground. And I had a cat in my yard. Now, my dog kills squirrels, he kills birds, he kills possums, he kills raccoons. My dog kills anything. He's in the backyard. And this is happening in the front yard. And so I called everybody and I said, how do you keep the cat out of your flower bed? And they said, well, he's attracted to the bird feeder. And so therefore, oh, that's wonderful. You come home one day and he's got one of your baby birds in his mouth. You are really thrilled about cat now. And so it began the war of who's going to win in the yard, me or the cat. And some people said, put mothballs. And so I put out mothballs, 10 pounds of mothballs out there. Now, the place stunk to high heaven, but it didn't bother the cat. People said, put cracked cayenne pepper out there, you know. And so I got two of them great big things from Sam's. And I mean, I had everything. I mean, I couldn't even walk across my yard barefooted without burning by my feet. It didn't bother the cat. People said, well, spray him with water. Sprayed him with water. Didn't bother the cat. So then I got me a pellet gun. And so I pumped it up and I shot the cat. And he would go meow, but he would come back. This must be an alley cat. I mean, you couldn't get rid of him, you know. I mean, he might have been an alcoholic cat. You know, I've always said alcoholics, people worry about if they do this, they'll leave. Alcoholics are harder to get rid of than the booger off your finger. You just can't do it. And that's the way this cat was. I just couldn't get rid of this damn cat. And so I pumped it up to about 6 times, and when I hit him, boy, I mean, he let out a scream, but he came back. So I pumped it up to 10, and I missed him and shot a hole in the neighbor's house. JD said, put the gun down. Put the gun down. So I put the gun down. And so this year, the new plan was, I heard another Al-Anon. She said, buy those cheap little plastic forks that are real picky, and then plant them in around the flowers when you first put the flowers in, and where the points are up, and then the cat can't walk on them. He likes to walk on the flowers, not the little pickies. It didn't bother him at all. Now, this cat is huge. He's a great big long-haired calico-looking thing, and he's huge. And so we tried the animal traps. He just sprays them and goes on. He doesn't care, you know, and it was just like, I just could. I said, all right, I've got it. Smith & Wesson. I've got a .38. I'm just going to blow that cat to kingdom come. I'm tired of messing with him now. 3 years I've had with the cat. I don't want the cat. And he's eating my squirrels. He's eating my baby birds, you know, and I'm really sick and tired of this cat. And so I was writing to a friend of mine, and he said, oh, you don't want to do that. And I said, what do you mean I don't want to do that? He said, well, I killed a dog one time, and the first shot I didn't kill him, and he screamed. And he says, I can hear those screams till today, and thank you so much for sharing. So now I have the horror, if I kill the cat, I won't kill the cat. And then he'll just lay out there, flip and scream, and I don't want that. I just don't want that. So I said, all right, I get it. I surrender. I'll accept the cat. By God, it's my cat. It's my yard cat. I love that son of a bitch. So I went out there and I said, welcome home, cat. And I said, I'm going to call you FC. So FC lays there and he goes, meow. The next morning, I'm standing there in my living room, and I'm looking out the window, and one of my happy squirrels has got a limb on my bonsai tree, and he's gnawing on it. I couldn't believe it. My Japanese bonsai! He's gnawing on my tree! I went screaming out into my front yard, stomping my feet. Let go of my tree! Let go of my tree! 5 squirrels just going crazy every which way. And I'm going, where the hell is my cat? Where's the cat that eats the squirrel? Where is the cat? He's not been back. I asked the girl who stays at my house when I'm gone last night. I said, is the cat back home? She said, haven't seen. The minute I accepted that cat, he went away. And you know, the funny part about that is, I know that is a principle. Whenever you accept something, when you surrender and accept it, it goes away. And it just never occurred to me that it worked on a cat. But now the really funny part of that story is, while I'm out there standing, screaming, yelling, "Where is my cat?" there's people going by my house that are going... You see, I'm out there in my panties and bra. Basic things for me. It defines my problem. It tells me I'm powerless. It defines my solution, that I don't have the power to do it. And it tells me how to bring about the solution. You know, all of that's outlined, and it tells me that the solution is in working the 12-step method of recovery, as outlined in the book. You know, it's amazing to me. We used to say in our preamble, we work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. They change stuff from time to time. And that was the thing, you know. But recovery begins when I'm willing to make a commitment to doing something different. When I'm ready to get a sponsor, when I'm ready to do the meetings, and most importantly, when I'm ready to do what I'm told to do without belly aching, questioning, and balking about it. That's when my recovery. You know, and it also, I get a lot of recovery when I share my experience, strength, and hope with other people. That helps me too. But the program is not for people who need it. It's one more time for people who want it. And see, I found that I have this disease, and the disease is a condition which separates people, you know, and we become isolated. In Al-Anon, we talk about suffering the loneliness of loneliness. We feel like we're the only people in the world that feel the way we do. And, you know, when I would hear the alcoholics talk about how isolated they feel, I thought, God, I know what that feeling's like. I know what that feeling is to have a hole in the middle of you with the wind blowing through. And so I began to see me on that book when I took the word drinking and substituted the word thinking. It's real simple. And then when it talks about the obsessive nature and other alcoholic traits, I thought, God, that's me. You know, I love people talk about the alcoholic personality. What is that? What is that? I don't know. I have the same thing. I don't know that it's an alcoholic personality. It says that, you know, it's a mental obsession of the mind. It's accompanied with irritability, restlessness, and the feeling of discontent. Describes me pretty much, wouldn't you say, about the cat? You know, when I was living in Newfoundland, you know, I had a lot of anger and restlessness and discontent, and I wasn't living with an alcoholic. I wasn't living with someone whose drinking bothered me. He bothered me when he wasn't drinking. Because I had a thing about my landlady, and I lived in an apartment. My landlady lived next door to me, you know. She's the one that I got her kids and went up the hill on the sled, you know. But I was irritable and restless, you know, and we had several little verbal altercations out there in the yard. And I didn't like her, and so I decided I would punish her. Because, see, revenge was a way of life for me. And they did not have door-to-door mail delivery. And she got really mad at me, and she told my husband she wouldn't accept the rent from me. Now, that's pretty bad when you won't take money from somebody. Shows you how bad she hated me. And I thought that was sort of funny. And so my husband said, well, I'll take it next door and pay her. I said, you will not. We'll mail it to her. And he said, but she'll have to walk 2 miles to the mailbox. I said, yeah. Every time I saw her walking, I'd go, yeah. You know, make her walk for it, you know. And then one day I was looking around in my house, and I said, it's real drab here in the bathroom. And when you were living in approved housing off base, they had to do certain things for in order to be able to rent their places to the Americans. And so I wanted a bathroom window. And I went to the housing authority, and I got them to come out, and they said, yeah, we can authorize a bathroom window. And I told her, I said, it's been authorized. They sent her a letter, and I waited, and I didn't have a bathroom window. And God, I'd waited 3 or 4 days. And when I want a window, I want a window. And so I took a hatchet, and I chopped a hole in the wall. I got a window. We went to war over a lot. See, I was constantly doing stuff. And it, you know, that irritability, that restlessness and discontent was always focused. It was if she'd do this, if he'd do that, if they'd do this, then I could be okay. And when this didn't fix me, then I had the clubs.
God, I loved to go to the clubs because there was always laughter in the clubs. There was the drinking that was going on, and daily drinking became a part of my life. You know, so, you know, the solution for an alcoholic is leaving alcohol alone or abstinence. And if you don't, you go insane and die. Well, an Al-Anon has pretty much the same kind of deal. We have to learn to accept or we'll go insane and die. And if you don't think I wasn't going insane over the cat, you weren't living in my neighborhood. You know, and it just shows you, you can be obsessed about anything. You know, and over the years, the more I look at it, when you see alcoholics come in and get sober, what do you got? A screaming Al-Anon. That's what you got, you know. You know, it just appears to me, because we all have the same problems once they're sober. Our problems are all the same. Now, an allergy is an abnormal reaction to something. Well, my allergy is abnormal behavior, you know. When I'd see the alcoholic, my behavior would get weird. You know, and I could go from fear to anger to rage to revenge to murder. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't a big stretch. You know, I've left my car many times to go somewhere. I've gone in my car. And when I get to where I'm going, I don't even remember leaving home. Now, you know, that's, you know, driving in a brownout, you know. And what if something were to happen to you on the way that you needed to, you weren't there. It's like, where were you? I don't know. I was in my head. That's where I was. I was going around and around up here. It's like the car was on automatic pilot, you know, just going on down the road. And see, I know what allergies are all about. You know, I've got sinus allergies. I'm allergic to insect stings. My mother said that's the reason I'm so mean. I stuck my head in a wasp nest when I was a little child helping my daddy pick peaches in the backyard. And they just swarmed all over me. And the only thing I remember about that, I was 5 years old, was I remember they wouldn't let me go to sleep. And I was so tired and wanted to go to sleep. And they wouldn't let me. And the doctors had said that it was very bad if I had gone to sleep. But as a result, I'm extremely allergic to stuff like that. So, you know, and then I had this thing about tangerines, you know. I'm allergic to tangerines. And I didn't used to be, but you see, I abuse tangerines. You know, I always liked tangerines, and I would tell myself, they're small, eat three. You know, and then you have the size of an orange. And I forget, and one weekend I bought 3 dozen tangerines. And on Sunday night I asked J.D. what in the hell he had done with my tangerines. And he said, I hadn't touched your tangerines. I said, you have to. They're not here. He said, you've eaten. I said, I have not eaten 3 dozen tangerines in 3 days. He said, yeah, you have. Well, on Monday morning I couldn't wake up. I tried, but my eyes just wouldn't go. And they were just, I looked like the fly, you know. And so I went to the eye doctor. I couldn't figure out what had happened to me. And he said, well, it looks like an allergic reaction to something. Have you done anything different? I said, no. And I was being sincere, you know. And then he said, well, have you been around anything unusual? I said, no. And he said, well, have you eaten anything different? No. And he says, well, I just can't fit. I said, well, I did have some tangerines. And he said, well, I don't think tangerines would. He said, how many did you have? And I said, 3. And doesn't that sound like the alcoholic? How many drinks you had? 2, couple, you know. At least the Al-Anon, I could go to 3. And he said, 3 tangerines wouldn't do that. And I said, well, 3 dozen. And he said, what? And I said, well, 3 dozen. He said, 3 dozen tangerines? God, when he said it, it sounded so bad, you know. You know, if you just don't hear it like that, you know. And he said, yeah, that'd probably do it. And so to this day, when I buy tangerines, I go to the store and I buy 1 tangerine. Because I know if I buy 6, I'll eat 6. If I buy a dozen, I'll eat a dozen. It's like the alcohol. Once I take the peeling off, it's till it's gone. I mean, there it is. You know. And I never could understand why J.D. would throw the cap on the bottle away. You see, I wasn't relating to the obsession, the need to go ahead and to do. You know, and even though I knew it would swell my eyes shut, I'd go ahead and I would eat the tangerines. And that's that insanity. The insanity of alcoholism, doing the same things over and over and over and expecting different results, you know. And so what I would do also is I would go over and over to person wanting to be loved. And when Bill shares in his stories his feelings of loneliness and his need for excitement, need to feel important, God, I could relate to Bill, you know. You know, and then the thing of it is, I'd do the things I do, and then I'd look, I can remember getting up in the morning and looking in the mirror and going, God, I got to where I couldn't look in the mirror anymore. You'd put your makeup on, but you couldn't look in the mirror. And one of the things I was told to do when I came in the program was do mirror talk. And I said, what's that? And they said, talk to yourself in the mirror. I couldn't do that. I couldn't look at me in the mirror. See, when I looked in the mirror, I got sick about what I saw. I saw all of that stuff that I had done. And those eyes were dead. There wasn't any light on in those eyes. And I just didn't want to do it. It took me a long time to go ahead and to do what my sponsor said. I'd go over there and I'd look in the mirror and I'd do those things. But it took a long time before that feeling of unworthiness and that self-loathing went away when I'd look in a mirror. But I had a lot of hope in Bill's story. You know, and he said there was scarcely any form of trouble or misery which has not been overcome among us. My God, you know, talk about promises on 83 and 84. There is a big promise. The thing that there's not anything that's happening out there that we can't go through together. That was a big promise to me. And, you know, no matter what you're going to do, it's like Benoit and I were talking earlier, life happens. And sometimes, you know, it's just like in 1995, I had a horrible year. And I was depressed pretty much that whole year. And people would say, well, no, you've got a program. Hell yes, if I hadn't had a program, I'd have blown my brains out, for God's sake. You know, but the bottom line is you still got to go and you still got to feel the feelings, but you don't have to do it alone and there's people there to walk with you through it. And sometimes the kindest thing you can do when somebody's doing that is just be there and just love them. Just love them because they're going to have to do what they got to do. You know, they're going to have to hurt and suffer with it as long as they have to hurt and suffer with it. And grief's like that. And it was like I lost 9 friends that year. And it's like, how do you just go from person to person? And my sister nearly died on me. And then the horror of that, you know. So, I mean, it was bad, you know. And the worst things that's ever happened to us have happened since sobriety, since we've been in the program. You just think they're bad before you get here. You know, because J.D.'s mom died right after we were here. And then I had the ordeal all those years with my mother and the horror of her death. And then my sister's heart disease. And her diabetes is still a problem because she still will not accept. She's in total denial about her diabetes. And we've had problems with finances. We're having problems now getting old and accepting the limitations, you know. You can't do what you used to could do in the same amount of time. You know, you just can't do it. You can't think like you used to think. You can't remember people's name. You see a face and you go, God, what is the name? You know, and it's like used to you didn't have that problem. But now you begin to have that problem and you have to accept and learn to roll with that. And I'm in here with other senile people, so it's okay. You know, in a solution it talks about there are people who wouldn't normally mix. And God, isn't that the truth? You know, I wouldn't be called dead with some of y'all before. I remember one time I was in Palm Springs and I was sitting there in my room and there was these two people from Denmark that were sitting there. And there was a girl and a guy from Sweden. And then there was this girl, Mexican girl. And then there was this Chinese girl married to a black man. And we were all sitting there eating salsa and telling dirty jokes. And I thought, this is life. This is fun. You know, these are the fun things. You know, I mean, you just, you know, it's a common problem. It's a common solution, you know. And it tells you in the book that sobriety is only a beginning. You know, it's not the goal. It's just the starting point. And his sobriety, it belongs to him. I don't have anything to do with it. And see, for a long time, I thought that if I went to Al-Anon, I could help keep him sober. That Al-Anon was going to give me the formula that I could help keep him sober. And, you know, you keep listening for it and you don't hear it, you know. And I found that his sobriety belongs to him. I can't take credit for his sobriety. And guess what? I don't have to take credit for the drunk either, you know. That's the thing. I'm not responsible, you know. I can't cause it. I can't control it. I can't cure it, you know. And alcoholics have 3 C's too, you know that? Con them, confuse them, and conquer. You know, I learned that a long time ago. But the problem is in our mind. It's in our mind. And we don't know why we do the things we do. How many times have you told yourself, I'm not going to do that, only to find yourself doing it? And so there's something that's missing the gap up here, you know? And the book talks about stinking thinking, you know? And I'm familiar with that, that this time it's going to be different. Now, in 1985, I quit smoking. And I can't tell you the number of times the thought has crossed my mind, boy, wouldn't a cigarette taste good after this meal? Yes, it would. I know it would. But I know there's no way to take one cigarette. You know, and that's where the program comes. Every time my mind says, this time it'll be different, it's like bells go off. And you go, I've heard that before. That's insanity. And now I'm aware when I'm having the insane thoughts, you know. There it is. This time it's going to be different. It's not going to be any different, you know. But I identified too with the jaywalker. I love that part in the book where it talks about the jaywalker. Good God. You know, how many times I've done that one? I've done it with men, credit cards, relationships, finances. You know, jaywalking is just, I mean, that's just a really good illustration, but I've done it. You know, it's like that story of going down the street and you fall in a hole. And you get all banged up, you know, and you get out and you go the next day and you go down the same street. And you fall in the hole. And you get out and you think, well, God, there's a hole in this street. So the next day you're going, you're looking, you see the hole and you step around the hole. There comes a day when you have enough sense to go down a different street. You know, it just takes a while. It just takes a while. But that's what that reminded me of, the story of the jaywalker. Now, in order to overcome that thinking, it says that you have to have a spiritual experience that will be sufficient to give you some sane thinking, you know, and aware that God's doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself. You know, and there's times I have no mental defense against thinking, you know. My defense must come from a higher power. Because, you know, I've learned, if anything, that the mind is a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go in alone. And at home, we tell you, if your thinking's broken, try not to use it so much. You know, that's the thing, you know, that no mental defense against the crazy thoughts. Because there's hardly a day goes by that I don't identify a crazy thought. And God knows how many goes by that I just miss that they're crazy. But the exact directions for recovery are given in the book, not a theory. It says precisely and specifically. I mean, it has really powerful words. And it challenges you. If you don't think you need the program, go out there and try some controlled drinking or go out there and see what results you get, you know. And I'm real grateful for the people in our group that have gone out. We call them retreads, those that come back the second time. I'm real grateful because, you know, they look so bad, and I think they're doing it so I don't have to. Because when I see how bad they look, I know it ain't any better out there. It's not any better than it was out there when I came in, so I know I don't want to do that anymore. But you have to learn the proper use of your will, and that is to turn things over. That's the proper use of your will. I learned that in the book. I didn't realize there was a difference between being religious and spiritual. I didn't know that until I read the chapter on we agnostics. You know, I didn't know I was an agnostic until I read it. I don't think I had ever even heard the term. I just didn't think I believed in God, but I believed there was a God, you know. And I didn't understand the God I had. I don't know who understood the God I had. And it isn't important, you know, but it's not really so important that I understand God as that I know that God understands me. And that's what I've learned there. And I have to be willing to start the process no matter how small. No matter, you know, you've got to start somewhere. You've got to have some little place. And the book assures me that whenever the moment I begin to believe, or am even willing to believe, that I'm on my way. That's very encouraging to me. Very encouraging. Do I believe, or am I willing to believe in a power greater than myself, was the question. And, you know, for a long time I felt that if you don't ask God for anything, then God may be there. But if you ask and He doesn't do it, that means He's not there for you. So I wouldn't ask. It took me a long time to be able to ask God and to identify and know that I was asking God. And that's the reason I told Him, you know, hey, this is Mary Pearl at 409 Healy Street. I just didn't want Him confusing me with anybody else, you know. I wanted to know that God was going to do something for me, that He was going to be there and going to take care of me. And you know, it says care of God. That means God cares. God cares for you. And I didn't have much faith that God would work because I had this real spirit of unworthiness. You know, I had done a lot of not good things. I had done a lot of bad things. In fact, I had pretty much broken every one of my own belief systems. You know, I had gone systematically down through my belief system, what I believed in, and had just zip, 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 crossed them off. I had done everything I said I wouldn't do. You know, I haven't been to Australia yet, girlfriends. For those of you who heard me before. But I didn't have faith that God would work in my life. But I've learned that faith is a strange thing. It's like having a muscle. And a muscle may be flabby and soft and what have you, but when you begin to use it just a little bit, it begins to tighten up and it begins to firm up. And then if you use it long enough and consistently enough, it becomes very strong. And that's the way that faith had worked for me. Now, I heard people share in rooms like this over and over what God did for them, what they couldn't do for themselves. And as I became willing to believe that God would do with that, He continues to do those things for me too. You know, it's not like He'll do it for us and He won't do it for you. He'll do it for anybody that believes and asks Him to do it, you know. And when my awareness of God today is the most powerful reason I have for even having faith. You see, I've seen results. I know it works. Faith works. And either God is or He isn't. You know, it's pretty simple. God's everything or he's nothing. And it tells us in the book that some grow spiritually slowly and others faster. And I was glad to hear that too. Because, you know, after hearing about Bill's experience, which was instantaneous, you know, I thought, God, I didn't have that, you know. Mine was more a daily gradual awareness as things come on, and always sort of in retrospect. You know, things happen and then you look back and say, oh yeah, I remember now that happened and this was what was going on. But it says, the main thing is that God comes to all who seek him. Now that's a pretty powerful statement. To me, that's another promise right there. I really, really was glad about that. Now the book talks about types of drinkers. I always get amused at those. Because in Al-Anon we have types of thinkers. It says there's the moderate one. And to me that's the person who can accept life on life's terms pretty well. The person who's not too deranged. And then we have the hard thinker, that person who studies a lot, that can modify their behavior even if difficult sometimes. But then there's the real Al-Anon. And that's the one who's lost control over his thinking and does incredibly tragic things trying to control other people. He's irritable, restless, discontent, and fearful. And that described me. That described me. My main problem was me, you know. All my life I talked about the hypocrites in the church. You know, the people said, we love you and then don't come in. And, you know, we want to help you save your soul, but don't wear pants. I said, these are hypocrites, you know, but yet I was a hypocrite. I just did it in different ways. You know, I do it in things like, you know, we hate our defects when we see them in other people. And that's the reason I hated that so much. Because I'd say one thing and do another too. That was exactly, you know, but I had to find that God was working for me in a way, and he'd have to do impossible things for me in order for me to see it. Because anything that I could justify or rationalize wasn't God, you know. And so I would be in there, and that was the reason when I got paid that check, when there wasn't any money coming in, and J.D. having money in his pants pocket that time when we were wanting to go to a convention, just the $30 that we needed appeared in his pants pocket, you know, the $35. And God continues to work like that in my life. You know, those miracles, those things that happen that are impossible to explain in any other way. Now, either I'm having a spiritual experience, a hot flash, or the air conditioning has gone. Now, I shared with y'all a few about 6 or 7 years ago how I got a computer. And I told you that I thought I needed a computer. People told me I needed a computer, but I was afraid I couldn't learn how to use a computer. And so, but anyway, I took an action. I started a computer fund, and in about 4 months, I had $30. It's a start! Anyway, I went over to this girl that I was sponsoring. Her boyfriend was an attorney, and we went over to their house. And he gave me a computer that year for Christmas. He was an old one. He was putting a new one in his office, so he gave me his old computer. And I said, is it IBM compatible? See, I knew some of the words. And he said, it's an IBM. I said, oh. See, that throws you, you know. Is an IBM compatible, you know. Well, I used that computer all these years, and finally, you know, the memory just went, it went like mine, it just filled up. And they couldn't do anything. It was just a little 286, but God, I loved it, and I was scared to death, and I'm saying, I need something bigger and better. And then I'd hear all these terms, and I just didn't have a clue what people were talking about, RIM, ROM, RAM, whatever, you know. And basically, I had a word processor is what I was using it for, and I didn't even realize about all the stuff that was out there because mine didn't have enough memory to put anything on, so it wasn't anything to worry about. And I told J.D., though, I said, I'd really like to be able to do some more things, and so we talked about it, and we prayed about it, and I went shopping. And I went looking. Now, if you really want to get confused, you go to one of these two or three computer stores, you know, and they'll have this one is the same. And, oh, wait, but you got to have this one over here, and this one has this, and you know, this one stands up and waves at you, and this one talks to you, and oh my God! Now, and do you want this one, or do you want a PC, or do you want an Apple? An Apple's a fruit. What are you doing, you know? And so finally, I sit down and I prayed about it, and I told JD, I said, I think this is the one I want. And he said, well, go get it then, and we'll get it for you for Christmas. And I said, well, gosh, that's an awful lot of money. I said, J.D., that's over $3,000, you know, to get this one, because, I mean, this one is really nifty. And I said, it's like a 4X, and it's whatever. And he's going, yeah, yeah. Because, see, J.D. knows less than I do, which is, you know, the blind leading the blind at our house. Anyway, I said, okay, this is the decision. And so I said, this is what I'm going to do tomorrow. 15 minutes later, the telephone rang. 15 minutes. And this man said, hello, this is Santa Claus. Now, I have a lot of weird friends, you know. And I'm thinking, this is a joke. And I said, is this a joke? And he said, no. And he said, I live up in the north. And I said, you do? He said, yeah, I live in South Dakota. And I said, oh, you do? And he said, yeah, I live at Gateway. And I said, so? And he said, well, a bunch of the elves have gotten together and decide that you need a computer that'll last you for a lifetime, and so we're building you one, and we're going to send it to you. And I said, who? And he said, they told me to say they prefer to remain anonymous. And I said, you're kidding. He said, no, it won't be there in time for Christmas. But he said, it'll be there after the first of the year. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, and they're throwing in a color printer, too. Now, this was better than what I was going to buy, you know. And when I got it, you know, it was a 12X CD-ROM. And, you know, it had all this fantastic amounts of memory and stuff that went with it. And I'm going, my God, how will I ever, ever get it put together? You know, I mean, I don't know anything about this kind of stuff. And this girl that used to work in computers had come over and put my other one together, and she doesn't even go to Al-Anon anymore. You know. How dare she quit when I was going to need her? And one of the gentlemen that I sponsor owns a big company, and he said he was sending over the head of his computer department, and he did, and he put it together and showed me how to use my computer. And it does everything but walk. It does walk and talk. I mean, I'm here to tell you. And I've learned more in the last 6 months than I knew in the past 7 years. And, you know, and it has really been a help to me. And if you want to understand powerlessness, get you a computer. I mean, it tells you stuff. You find yourself talking to a screen. I swear to God, you do. It puts up little messages, and you go, well, what the hell does that mean? You've made a fatal error. Well, good for me. We're going to shut you down. Well, go right ahead. Well, now what do? It's locked. You know, I mean, it's like I never had that problem with the other one. And I told the little guy, and he said, the other one didn't do anything. And he says, now that you got one that does everything, it screws up frequently. He says, that's the nature of them. He said, they're just made to drive you crazy. I said, well, I'm there. But, you know, that's another thing, though. See, that's God doing for me. Because, you see, God knew something I didn't know. He knew that I was going to need a new washer and dryer and refrigerator in the next few weeks. And I wouldn't have been able to do that if I'd have went ahead and bought that computer. It would have been just too much. So, you see, God goes ahead and He plans in love. At least my God does. But there's more than just things, you know. I begin to trust. I could be calm in an emergency. I could be sane and courteous to people on the road. That was a big deal. You know, I'm a crazy person on the road. And I could trust God with my finances. I could trust God with my loved ones. I could trust God with my own life. And that was a big change for me. And as I would listen to other people share about their higher power, it gave me hope and willingness to try to turn more over and more over and more over. And so today I believe that there is a God. And if there isn't, what have I lost? But if I don't believe and there is, I've lost everything. And I'm not that kind of gambler. Why take that kind of chance? And I learned that God lives inside of everybody. You know, He's our inner resource. And we come with God already installed. He's not something that you have to add on, you know. I thought for a while that that's sort of the way God was, you know, that there was a plug out. You know, God is already installed. All you have to do is be quiet because He's waiting on the inside just to be recognized and for us to ask for His help. That's all God's asking for us, you know. And that's the biggest resource you're ever going to have in your life is that inner strength that you have. And you have it whether you know it's there or not. It is there. All you have to do is just tap it. And these ideas helped me to get rid of those prejudices they had. And they helped me to look inside myself. And guess what? When I found God, I found Mary Pearl. You know. And I prefer to believe that God, I believe in God because it works for me. You know, that's one of the main things. It works for me. And I found that God comes to those who seek Him, who honestly look for Him. And I sought, He came, and I became whole. That's what filled up the hole inside of me. So my answers were spiritual because my problems were spiritual. When I get out of whack spiritually, it makes my thinking weird. It makes my emotions weird. And when they get weird, the actions follow, you know. So that's what I have to do. Now my answers were in the program of action, and that's where it started out in the how. How to work the program in chapter 5. But you see, all that other stuff, I hate it when people say, open the book to chapter 5. Because you're missing the whole deal if you don't go for, you know, it's just like reading the end of the book. You miss the book. Why read the book if you're going to read the ending, you know? So you start at the front of the book. And on the chapter 5 began to tell me what actions to take that are going to make my life different. Those actions that will make my life different. And there were some key words, you know, like thoroughly, you know. This is not hit or miss, but you got to be consistent and then willing to go to any length. I love people when they say, oh, God, it takes 15 minutes to get to the meeting. I don't have that kind of time. You know, when I think about people out in California that drive an hour and a half one way, you know, to get to a meeting, it's not that many miles, but when you're in that moving parking lot on the freeway, you know, it just takes forever. And the people at home, they just have a conniption if they have to. And I can remember, you know, we would go to meetings in these little other towns and around because you either went there to take a meeting or to help another group get started, or you were going over there to there's been many times I've gone to those meetings not to take anything, but to slurp something up, to go be a sponge, because, you know, you're not up every day of your life. It's just not that way. And then it says, you know, you tried to hold on to old ideas. You know, that was what I had done, doing the same things over and over, getting those same crappy results. That's what old ideas do for you. And the results are nil till you let go absolutely. And you quit debating and you surrender to thinking other than your own. That's all that meant to me. And then our thinking is cunning, baffling, and powerful. Well, I couldn't trust my thinking. My best thinking told me to kill J.D., and it still does. Sometimes I look at him and I think he needs to die. You know, that's what my thinking will do for me. Aren't you glad you're here to hear this, honey? And it says, without help, it's too much for us. That tells you you're going to need God and other people. You're going to need help from outside yourself. And the half measures avail you nothing. You know, you'd think if you worked half, you'd get half, but it doesn't work that way here. And if my thinking was sick, then I had to accept the three things. And that I was obsessive, compulsive, and couldn't manage my own life. That probably no human power could have restored my sanity, and that God couldn't would if He were sought. All of this worked so well for me. And then I found a prayer that was going to help change my life, and that was the third step prayer. It took me a long time. I said the words for a long time before I ever knew what they meant, you know. Relieve me of the bondage of self. What exactly was the bondage of self? You know, I did a lot of prayer and meditation, talked to my sponsor and a lot of people about the bondage of self. And that no matter, it doesn't hurt to tell God what you want as long as you tell Him, not my will but yours, you know. Thy love, thy way of life, may I do thy will always, not my will. And then that inventory, that written list of your assets and liabilities, those things that shut me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. You know, I learned that I had to live and be free of the anger because the book told me I wasn't mature enough to know how to handle anger. And I resented the fact that the book told me I was immature, but I can totally concur with that today. You know, you take it as, and each year as you go through it and as you continue to work the program, you'll realize how much you don't know. You know, when I was about 5 years in the program, I pretty much knew everything. I think that's sort of a curse of about a five-year-old. They know everything. And then there was a period in time when you think you know more than your teachers, and then all of a sudden you grow up and you realize you don't know. And when you don't know is when you can learn. Because if you don't know, then you're willing to listen, you know. And all I knew that was the anger that I had inside of me, the only way I knew how to deal with that anger was to hurt other people. And that was because it brought revenge, and revenge always brought violence for me. And I didn't know a healthy way to work through my emotions, and then the book gave me the tools. And I learned, too, that the people that had harmed me were spiritually sick, and that they had not done that on purpose to hurt me. They did that because they, in fact, were hurting. And, you know, it's sort of like, have you ever saw a dog hit on the side of the road? If you go to try to help the dog, he'll bite you. Because he feels the pain, but he doesn't know where the pain is coming from, and that's just how I was. I was a hit dog on the side of the road. I bit people who were trying to help me, you know. And it's working the program is hard sometimes. It's really hard to be to avoid retaliation and to go back and do those things. You know, instinctively, when something happens, the first inclination I'll have will be the old thought. It's been there, you know. I've been trying to do it a new way for 20 years, but that's just a drop in the bucket. Hell, I'm 55. I've done it a long time the other way. And so that thought's going to be first, and then it follows with, no, we don't do that anymore. You know, it's like a self-correction process in your head. And I had to learn to give J.D. the right to be right as well as the right to be wrong. And I had to cease fighting with him over things. And we had a major war here. Started 2 years ago. You know, it was the cat, it was him. You know, I've had these little ongoing things. I went to Kentucky one weekend and I came back and J.D. and I had talked. I take that back. J.D. had talked. I had never considered it in my mind. You know, I mean, he would talk and I would block it out because it wasn't what I wanted to hear. You know how that goes? And we call it communication. And J.D. had talked about wanting to build a water garden in the backyard. Well, now, our backyard looks like rooms in a house as it is. We have the cactus garden. We have the meditation garden. We have the turtle arena. We've got all these wonderful things out there, and thank God we have a big backyard. But J.D. said he wanted a water garden, and he was showing me pictures and in this book, and I heard in my mind that it was going to be about maybe 6 foot long and about 3 foot wide. And I'm thinking, well, That's not too bad. And so I came home from Kentucky, and it was late on Sunday night, and I went to bed, and next morning I got up, and J.D. had gone to work, and I was talking to my sponsor on the phone. Then I got up and I put on my glasses, and my world came into view, and everything focused, and I went, oh my God, I'm in a river of mud, because my carpet was all muddy. There was mud on my furniture. You see those? I have these two poodles that have dog doors. And they had been out in the backyard romping and rolling in the river of mud. You see, J.D. had dug the water garden while I was gone. He failed to mention that. And it was a little bigger. You know how the alcoholic bigger's better, too? You know, I mean, he has that, too. And the 3x6 became 18x12. Now, a standard water garden is about 18 inches deep. Ours is 5 foot. We have a pond or pool, however you want to put it. But at that point, it was an empty, muddy hole because it rained all night, and he never thinks ahead. And so it was like, what do you do with each wheelbarrow of dirt, of which they are legion? And it's like, I'll dump them and spread them across the yard. We'll build the yard up. He didn't think it was going to rain for several months, obviously. And so, I mean, I just went hysterical. And I bathed my dogs and I put them on leashes, which they're saying, why do we have to go out on a leash? And I'm saying, because your daddy has screwed up the backyard. And so when J.D. came home, I looked at him and I said, I don't want anything from you other than a solution. And he walked in the house, and then he saw the river of mud. And when I came back in from walking the dogs, he had his head in his hands going, oh, God, oh, God. I said, I've got you now. What are you going to do about it? And he said, well, we're going to build a fence. We're going to build a fence. And so we had our backyard cross fence for several months as the water garden took place. And then we have an annual yard party in May of every year, and I'm saying, well, where are we going to put people? Inside the fence? I mean, where are we going to put people? And so he got with a friend of ours, and he sodded half the yard. Half the yard. And so now we have green on top instead of brown, you know. And I'm saying, but what about the other half of the yard? Well, we ran out of sod. I don't know where they were getting the sod. Don't even want to go there. And I looked for yards that, you know, I averaged in the paper, a stolen yard. You know, I'm looking. You know, because he was pretty frantic because I was mad. I mean, it was like I had the dogs under each arm. We're going to a motel. We'll be back whenever this is done. You know, we're leaving you. And I came home one afternoon, and he had astroturfed the backyard. Now, the purpose of putting in the water garden himself was to save money. I forgot to mention that on the front end. You know, the water garden, I mean, we could have had three swimming pools for what we have a water garden for now. But, you know, this was war. I wanted to kill him every time something went wrong. And I told him, I said, the dogs are not going out in the backyard because I said they'll drown in the pool. And he said, well, they can swim. I said, not forever. Because he had gotten these beautiful big sheets of marble and broke them up with a hammer and made a mosaic design around the pool. It made it look like a swimming pool. It did not look like a water garden in any way. He says, isn't it different? He said, can you tell me what it is you don't like about the water garden? And I said, the water garden. I resented being left out of the loop, number one. To come home, I hated the sneakiness of it, doing it and not telling you. That was another thing, you know. Only I'm allowed to do that. The dimensions were beyond belief. And the fact that the dogs could run across the yard and go right across that marble and right into the pond when there's no way to get back out was not going to get it. And so J.D. says, you're being a fanatic. And I said, maybe so, but the dogs aren't going in there. And as y'all know, J.D. raises turtles, and he has these beautiful box turtles. And one afternoon, there were two turtles floating upside down in the pond. You see, they can't swim forever either. And I was so glad that it was the turtles, because if it had been one of my dogs, J.D. would have been in the pond. But you know, the part that really proves to me that that you never get well in this program, you would think a man who has been drowned would not build another water hazard. Sobriety is but a beginning. The thing about it is, I have to learn about me and admit the nature of my wrongs, as it says in the steps, and then become to live without those coping mechanisms, those things that I did that separated me from God and other people. Talks about it in the 7-step prayer. And in 8, I learned to take responsibility for those harms that I've done and to make the amends. And you know, one of the hardest amends was to make to the ex-husband, you know, to make to the ex-husband, because I had done him a lot of wrong. And it took me probably 5 or 6 years to get around to doing that. And I justified and rationalized, except when to do so. Boy, don't you love that one. And, you know, it doesn't say whenever, it says wherever on that. And when I finally did that, I had a freedom come over me that was unlike anything I had had. You know, these steps are for us. They're not for the other people. They're for us. They're for the person who does it. You know, it says in the book, an alcoholic's like a tornado. Well, you know, Al-Anons are tornadoes too. We're a whirling dervishes at any rate. And, you know, just as sobriety is not enough for the alcoholic, you know, he has a lot of work to do, so do I. I have a lot of relationships and things that I had damaged over the years. And this was long before I married an alcoholic. Long before, you know. And talking the talk's easy. You can come around these rooms, and in a few months you can get a handle on the jargon and what have you, but walking the walk is another thing. And I think a lot of us talk the talk before we walk the walk. You do what you can do. But it has helped me to have healthy relationships today, you know. You know, I had to do the things I didn't want to do in order to get the results that I wanted to have. And making amends when I'm wrong and forgiving myself is learning how to live. You know, I'm learning to go with the flow instead of being like the darn salmon that, you know, has to kill himself, you know, going back up. You know, he has to go against the flow. He has to bang himself on the rock so that when he gets to the other end, he dies. He's wasted all of his energy. And that was the way I did stuff all my life. And then, you know, it tells you there in the book on pages 83 and 84 about the promises that will come true in your life. But, you know, there's so many more promises, like I say, throughout the book, and that's what I want. And then step 10 helps me to grow in understanding and effectiveness. And it says, love and tolerance is our code. Sometimes I go, love and tolerance is our code? You know, that's really hard for me. But this is where I learned to develop my God consciousness. Because the more that I am in touch with my step 10, 11, and 12, the more I am able to be loving and tolerant of other people. You know, and working on your God relationship in step 11, it's just like anything else. You know, you develop a relationship in 2 and 3, and then you have to work on it. You know, I couldn't believe Mr. Trump when he said he wouldn't have a relationship he had to work on. You know, I thought, good Lord in heaven. You know, I just couldn't believe that. Because my relationships, I have to work on my relationships with the people I love, especially because, you know, those are the people that I can get the maddest at, is the people that I love. It's because I care the most about those people. Those are the ones that can just really do you up. And I learned that in that step 11 that I've got to spend time with God. If I'm going to have a relationship with you, I've got to spend some time with you. I've got to get to know you. I've got to feel comfortable with you. And that's what the meditation process was all about for me. And it's very important. It requires a lot of effort on my part. You know, it says salt. That tells me you got to seek, you got to look, you got to do more than just show up occasionally. You know, you got to do more. And then step 12 was carrying the message, you know. Practicing the principles in all our affairs. And how do you do that? How do you go about carrying the message? Well, the book tells you in chapter 7. Tells you exactly. You know, and when you're reading the book and it tells you how to work with other people, it tells you that, first of all, don't forget they're sick. You know, sometimes we expect people, newcomers coming in, to get well overnight. And we try to give them too much too soon. We forget you got to crawl before you walk. And it says, don't be an evangelist or a reformer. You know, those are really good guidelines because it's real funny. It's just like when you become a reformed smoker, you all of a sudden, you just want to go out and get the whole world to quit doing it, you know. And that's the same thing with Al-Anon. You get a little bit of recovery. You go out and you want to evangelize, and that's not what it's about. Just being helpful is what it's about. Don't try to force them to change. If they want to stay sick, let them stay sick. It also tells you that if the person doesn't want what you've got to give, let them go and go on to somebody who does. Now, I don't know about you, but in Al-Anon, we have a tendency, we want to just stand there and we're going to give it to them for God until they get it, you know. And we're not giving up on this one. We're not letting this one go, you know. And the bottom line is, every time I've done that, they end up going anyway, and then there you are. And you've wasted all that time and energy on somebody that doesn't want it. And it tells you to describe how you came to believe. In other words, don't be afraid to talk to God. Tell them about God. Don't be afraid of that. And also, you know, one of the most important things is recovery is not dependent upon people. It's dependent upon God. You know, and it's real important. So my main job there is just to be of helpfulness to others. And then they have the chapter to the wives. Now, to the wives. Written in 1939. Al-Anon started in 1951. And it talks all about the do's and don'ts and how to keep people to recovery mutually. You know, and one of the neat thing about this is it in the book, in 1939, they're urging you to work the 12-step program. It's telling you in the book in 1939 that you're to work the program. Well, what program was that? It was a program in that book because that's all they had, you know. And if it hadn't happened that way, you know, it wouldn't work, you know. They're encouraging us to work the AA program because we got sick together as families. Let's get well together as families. And they were doing that. Then the chapter of the family afterward gives me lots of good actions to take. Lots of good actions. It emphasizes my need for tolerance, understanding, and love. It teaches me to turn that past to good account and to learn from the experience that I had. See, all along I had experiences, but I didn't learn from my experiences. That's the reason I keep having to have the same kinds of experiences over and over and over, because you didn't learn. And once you learn, you don't have to keep going back and having the cockamamies all the time. You don't have to do that. And another thing, have you ever noticed how much you can learn from other people? Used to, I would tell you, I cannot learn from another person. I have to do it myself. Well, today, I found that being a little more mature in the program, I don't always have to go out and kill myself. I can look at other people and say, I don't want to do that, you know. I can learn from other people and their experiences. And I think that's one of the signs of maturity that we get from being in the program. And it tells me not to keep secrets. Don't keep secrets. You know, and it tells you that the fellowship is a good place to open up the doors of those closets and to talk about those secrets and those things, because you're with other people, first of all, who are going to understand. Don't try to explain to someone who's never lived like we've lived about how you've lived, because they don't have a clue. You know, I used to go to people and say, my husband has a drinking problem. He's a drunk. And they'd say, divorce him. I have never heard anyone in the rooms of AA and Al-Anon, just because someone is an alcoholic, say, divorcing. Just because of that. And people are not going to say to you, how can you love an alcoholic? Because we're here because we do. You know, we're here because we love alcoholics and we've been affected by the disease of alcoholism. But the bottom line is, I am happiest when I am around a bunch of sober alcoholics. I'm still not thrilled with a wet alcoholic. You know, I had an experience in Hawaii with one here just a month or so ago. I went to I was staying in Kauai at the Hyatt, and I call it the aerobic hotel, because you have to walk miles to get to any place. And so I had gone from one end of the place, and I paced it off, and it was 1,250 paces from my room down to the laundry. And then you put your clothes in, and then you walk back to your room, another 1,250. And then you go down a 1,250, and you put the clothes in the dryer, and then you walk back to 1,250. And then you take the 1,250, and you go down to get your clothes out of the dryer. And someone has taken your wet clothes out of the dryer and put them over on a counter and have dried their clothes in your dryer. Love and tolerance is our code. It might have been on the first two 1,250s, but by now it's not. And so I put the clothes in another dryer, and I decide, rather than to walk the thing back. Now, you got to remember, I've been touring all day long, and I was tired. And so my sister had come down with me to fold clothes, which we didn't have to fold because they were still wet. And there was a gentleman there that was from South Carolina, and I asked him, I said, did you see by any chance someone put their clothes in, take the wet clothes out and lay them over here? And he said, no, ma'am, they were there and I came. And he said it sort of sincerely, so I really didn't even question that. And I said, well, we're going to wait and see who shows up to get the clothes out of the dryer. Well, in about 30 minutes, here it came. It was doing the little zigzag walk. I could smell it from 50 yards. And I said, wouldn't you know? Wouldn't you know? Well, I'm not well yet. So I followed it into the laundry room, and it's there, and it's perched, and it's opening my dryer. And it's taking out its claws. And I said, excuse me, sir. He said, hmm. And I said, would you like to explain to me why you took my clothes out of that dryer while they were wet and put your clothes in? I didn't do it! And I said, oh, really? I don't believe you. He said, I didn't do it! And I said, you didn't. And he said, no. There was this old man. That's it. There was this old man, and he was in here, and he took them out and put mine in. I said, now let me get this straight. You were standing here minding your own business, and this complete stranger rips open the door, throws my clothes over on there, rips yours out of your hands, puts them in there, starts to dry, and you're afraid to take them out and do the right thing. Is this your story? I didn't do it! And I thought to myself, this is not an alcoholic. An alcoholic would have had a much better story than that. A much better story than that. That was just too dumb. You know, and so my sister said to, oh, and the young guy, he was there, and he says, I was fearful. He said, I was afraid I was going to have to defend you there. And I said, no. I can take care of myself here. I said, I've had a lot of experience in this area. You know, I got thinking about it later, and I'm thinking, why did you have to stand there and confront him? You know, it's like, well, I had to let him know he did wrong. You know, not well yet, you know, not well yet. This chapter also tells me about anonymity. warning you about it. You know, it talks about the sensitivity of the alcoholic. Well, I got a newsflash. I can be as sensitive as any alcoholic ever was. All you have to do is just rub those little feelings, you know, the little fur the wrong way. Boy, and I can be sensitive as everything. And when you've got two people in the house both being sensitive, it can be pretty tricky sometimes. And it talks about being a person of extremes. My God, is that not my life? I have always been a person of extremes. And I lived in that world of make-believe, you know. And I don't have to do that because now I have a world where I have a purpose. There is a purpose for me. If you ever need to know what your purpose is to be of maximum service to your fellow man and to God. That's what your purpose is. If you haven't known before, let me tell you, that's it. That's it. You know. And we can, you know, it tells me too that I need to keep my head, can be in the clouds, but I need to keep my feet firmly planted on the ground. At home, we sort of say, you know, don't get so, you know, heavenly pure, you know, earthly good, you know, those kind of things. And one of the most marvelous parts of this book is when it talks about my personal favorite, happiness, joy, and freedom, you know. It says, we're not a glum lot. We insist upon having fun. Well, dear God in heaven, you know, I love having fun. I enjoy having fun, and I never have any more fun than I'm with y'all. It just makes it. It says, we insist on enjoying life, and cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness, you know? And sure, we're sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And that's the way I feel. I'm a person who is happy, joyous, and free, and I want to feel that way every day. And, you know, I get up every day and I tell myself I am, whether I feel like it or not, because I'm not a morning person, you know. It's hard to be happy, joyous, and free early in the morning. It's much easier to be happy, joyous, and free at midnight. But, you know, I believe in love and I believe in laughter. And so at my home group, which is the Rose City group, and we are known as the Big Book Black Belt Al-Anon Family Group at home, we have a group motto. And our motto is Rose City, where love and laughter come together in recovery. You know, because I feel that if your recovery doesn't have the love and laughter in it, it's missing a lot. It's missing a lot. And it says, avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. You know, my mother was one of the best examples to help me in this because my mother enjoyed being miserable more than anybody I have ever known in my life. And you hated to be around someone like that. That no matter what happens, they always got the wet blanket to throw on you. You know, I can remember one time when I got a new car and I drove over and I said, see my new cars, I bet you can't afford to pay for that. You know, immediately throwing that wet blanket on you. Or, you know, hey, I'm going to get married, you know, oh, really? You know, I mean, we break people's spirits with those kind of comments. And that's being miserable because people who are miserable want to pass on. You know, misery loves company. You know, and that's the same thing here in reverse, though, where we have the freedom and the love and the laughter. We want to share that, too. And it's much more inviting, you know, than it is to be miserable. God directs your life. And it's amazing to me sometimes the way God does it. Dorothy, like I say, my sister, got very, very ill. And I was supposed to go to New Orleans to do a step study. And I had taken her to the doctors all week long, in and out of doctor's offices, trying to figure out what was wrong with her. And she told me on Thursday, she said, well, my next... next appointment is Tuesday. And I said, well, that'll work. I said, J.D. can come over and check on you and what have you, and I'll go on down to New Orleans. And so I got up that morning and I dressed and got ready for my flight, and I thought, well, I'll call and check on Dorothy, and I didn't get an answer. And it scared me to death because she was in such bad shape. And so when I ran over there, I couldn't find my sister. Now, this is sort of amazing since I'm the only family she has. And I looked in the floor under the bed in case she had fallen out of bed and went under it. I mean, I was just desperate looking for her, and I'm going, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And the program has taught me that in a crisis, do what you would normally do to the best of your ability. And I said, normally I would be getting on a plane going to New Orleans, and so I will go get on the plane and go to New Orleans. And that was one of the hardest things I ever did. And when I got to Dallas to make my connection, I'm standing there and I don't believe what I'm seeing because gates 20 and 21, one is going to New Orleans, the other one is going back to Little Rock. And I'm going, God, I've got to make a decision. Do I need to go home and try to find Dorothy or what? I mean, I'm just really, really troubled. And so I went over to the bank of telephones there, and I began to call to see if I could find where Dorothy was. And I began to call her doctor, the different doctors, and then finally I found her primary care physician. He was out of town, but his assistant told me that my sister had been put in the hospital with heart failure. And said she was probably being admitted. So I called the hospital and I got a hold of my sister and I said, how could you do this? Where the hell were you? Why didn't you call me? You know, it's like she's dying, but I'm going to question her. And, you know, I was sort of like the Jack Webb of our family, just the facts. And she said, I didn't want to worry you. I said, well, you didn't. You scared the guts out of me, but you didn't worry me. I said, worry is such a small word compared to how I feel. And she said that the doctor told her that she had congestive heart failure. And I said, well, do I need to come home? I mean, how serious is this? What is the deal? She said, oh, well, it's not that big a deal, I don't think. And I'm thinking, yeah, it is a big deal. And she said, you go on. And see, that's the thing. My sister, you'd rather be with those people than with me. You know, so I mean, I've got this I'm working with, and every time I've ever needed you, you've always been with those people. Well, I'm with those people most of the time, and because I are one of those people, you know. But anyway, I'm there, and I don't know what to do, and so I'm praying. I'm saying, God, I don't know what to do. What should I do? What should I do? And so I hung up the phone, and I called a girl that I sponsor, and I said, Dorothy's at the hospital. And I explained briefly to her, and I said, they're calling the plane. I've got to decide what I'm going to do. And I said, I just don't know, but you need to get a hold to J.D. and tell him. That was the reason I was telling her. And I said, God, I need a sign. I need something to tell me definitively here. I don't need no just little something. I need a sign. I need to know if I need to get on the plane going back to Little Rock or if I should go on to New Orleans. And at that precise moment, here came Father Hillary being pushed in a wheelchair through the airport. And I said, Hillary, I need to talk to you. He said, we don't have time to talk, Murph. He said, we got to carry the message. What we do best. And I said, I don't believe that. I said, I'm going to New Orleans. So I got on the plane, cried all the way to New Orleans because I was so scared. And it was like, it's like I knew I needed to be in New Orleans, but there was a part of me that wanted to be back in Little Rock, even if I couldn't do a thing, but just to be there. And I went to where I was staying, and I called back, and the girl I sponsored answered the phone in my sister's room. And there were five or six people that I sponsored. And they took around the clock and stayed with J.D. there with my sister at the hospital the whole weekend. And when I heard their voices and I knew they were there, I knew they were doing for me what I couldn't do and that I was to do what I was supposed to do. I could carry a message, and that's what I could do that weekend. And I surrendered, let go, and I didn't worry about my sister that whole weekend. God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. And when I got back home, my sister... they had taken, in just 3 days' time, they'd taken over 50 pounds of fluid off of her heart. And they had to go on and do the heart surgery, and she had blood clots in her lungs. But, you know, I had people walk with me through that every step of the way. I never had to do that by myself. And I had lots of people there at the hospital that were staying with her, so I didn't have to stay over there. And the funniest one was this little newcomer to our group. He came in and they were all talking about, they was asking me, what can I do? And I say, well, just help me out by going over there at the hospital a little bit. It would help. And so this little young guy came up to me and he said, what hospital? What room? What's her name? And I said, okay. And I'm thinking, who is he? And so my sister said she came to at one point and she looked across and there was this complete stranger to her because she'd seen a lot of them in the past few weeks. And she said, who are you? And he said, oh, I'm John and I'm a newcomer, but I'm here. And he said, I heard that you needed people and I'm here. And she said, oh. And then later she said, did I dream that? I said, no, you didn't dream that. But that was neat. That was neat, you know. And he wanted to be a part of. So everybody was going to help. So he wanted to help too, you know. In the vision for you, it explains all about that. It's about our fellowship. We're not consigned to a life that is glum and boring And you don't have to be stupid. It becomes a substitute for the liquor. In my case, the fellowship became a substitute for the obsessing, the bitching, the craziness that was going on in my life. And you know, it tells you how Dr. Bob and Bill got together and how they saw the necessity of bringing the family members into the spiritual way of life. They invited the family members to those first open AA meetings. They invited the family members. They knew then it was a family illness. You know, it gives us hope when it talks about how more is going to be revealed. And it's because you never graduate. You just keep learning, and you're coming and learning and relearning and unlearning and relearning until your own house is in order. You know, the answers will come. The answers will come to you when your house is in order, when you don't have those resentments, when you don't have those things operating in your life. You'll be surprised how clear the answers can be sometimes. And it also tells you, you can't transmit what you don't have. You know, you cannot give away that you don't have, you know. And that's the reason that, you know, I wondered about doing this talk, because I said, I know it's not going to be popular in a lot of places where they're so adamant about the big book. But, you know, this is the message. You know, I want people to know it's there. It's there in the book, and the promises are there. And it's part of my spiritual growth, and it's part of my walk in recovery that I did it that way, you know. It tells you to abandon yourself to God as you understand God, and admit your faults to Him and your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of the past. Give freely of what you have and what you find, and then join us. You're going to have to keep working those steps over and over and over. You don't just do it once. You can't remain static. You know, I see people say, well, I'm coasting. Well, as far as I know, coasting goes downhill. It doesn't go up. I've never known one to coast their way up the hill. But it says, and we will be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. And surely you'll meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny, you know. I'm never alone. I must do the job if I want the results. It's work, but I get the results when I do the work. So, what's the objective of the big book? To get an alcoholic sober? No. For me to find that power greater than myself, which will solve all my problems. It doesn't have anything to do with drinking at all. And that's why the big book is mine. It's my manual for living. And when I forget what to do, it's right there in front of me. All I have to do is just pick it up. And it reminds me time after time that God has the power that I don't. And when I follow the directions, I get the results. So let me challenge you out there. If you're not familiar with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try studying it with an open mind and see if you too are on those pages. And if you are, my friend, you've got a great journey ahead of you, and someday you can say, the big book is mine. Thank you.